Is Yabu above a last minute ditch conversion to Christianity?
No, he's not above it.
He's in the white robes and he's got a dagger. He's like, wait, I just felt it. Christ entering my heart, brother. Yeah, it's like, we need to hold a full inquiry in this. We need to get the Pope in Rome involved. This is a miracle.
Yep.
Saint Yabushigi.
Welcome to Bald Move Prestige, the officially unofficial podcast for Hulu's Shogun. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking episode 9, chapter 9, whatever, Crimson Sky. Aaron, I was led to believe that Crimson Sky was going to be an all-out frontal assault on Osaka Castle. I don't know that that's exactly what we got in this episode, but I found it thrilling nonetheless. How about you?
Yeah, I was talking to our mutual friend Jay last night. We had just wrapped up our recording of Mr. Feeny, the podcast.
Nice
we do.
Plug. Mm-hmm. Where,
yeah, thank
can,
you.
Where can
thank
you find
you.
That if you are looking for it?
On Bald Move Pulp or the Wise Mr. Feeny a Car Feed. We talked about the Little House on the Prairie episode where Carolyn gets lockjaw. I'd gotten him into it, and he was like 5 episodes behind, and you know, the next week I talked to him, he was fully caught up and fully invested. And I asked him, I said, Hey, are you current on Shogun? He's like, actually the last week or two kind of stressed me out. I've kind of been putting it off until, I got some downtime. I'm like, yeah, I feel like we've gotten 3 red weddings in a row. I mean, it's clear that Torunaga, It's becoming increasingly clear to me that Torunaga's going to fight and probably going to win, but it's hard to see. And I also appreciate the political things that he was doing. And what's funny is like almost everyone on top knows what's happening, or at least Ishido does, but there's nothing they can really do to stop it because he's got them in, you know, it's kind of like you can recognize that you're being forked with a knight. But once you've been forked, you are going to lose a piece. There are no longer any good options. You can make less bad calls, but you're going to lose something. And the Uchiba kind of painting that picture to where it's like, look, you either kill her and all the royal families are going to rebel and you're going to be disgraced, or you can let her go and all the royal families know that they can just walk all over you. There's no longer any way for him to win politically, and Torunaga is just continuing to shit in the bathtub for him. Like, they're stuck in there with the turds.
I'm going to jump right to feedback here because Father Martin wrote in about that exact thing, and there's a word for it, where you put your opponent in a position where any move they make worsens their overall position. And it's a German word. I don't know how to pronounce it. Z-U-G-Z-W-A-N-G. My American mouth wants to say Zugzwang, but I'm pretty sure that's not it.
Zuschwan or something? I don't know.
I have no idea.
And the other thing is they kind of put us as viewers in that position where it's like 3 different times I'm like, shit, Mariko's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end of the episode, you're kind of like, okay, well, Shido's going to pull his bandit bullshit. But when the ninjas come out, I felt like that they were getting into a winning position, and then she pulls a Hodor, and then the episode doesn't, like, it's just over, and you're just dumped to a black screen with Father Martin chanting his litanies. Like, it's real gut punch moment. But everything leading up to that was so beautiful.
Mariko's whole episode is like a hold your breath moment, you know. As much as it was as long and as drawn out and as intense as that scene with Hiramatsu was, where he commits seppuku, this was maybe twice that because of its length. Because I mean, it spans almost the entire episode, and I care deeply about Mariko, maybe even more so than Hiramatsu because she's more of a character to me. I found myself just forgetting to breathe during this episode because I was so wrapped up and so worried for Mariko the entire time.
Yeah, and you have to give it to Anna Sawai, I think is her name. I listened to an interview on the official podcast, a lady that plays Mariko, and she's just like, when you listen to her speak, she sounds just like an American gal. and she's getting so much range. Like, she shows everything from the depths of sorrow and desolation to just wild, ferocious, feral samurai woman energy, mm-hmm. where she's just screaming in rage and frustration to, you know, steely resolve and triumph. And, you know, by the time Ochiba is kind of like saying, like, you know, you knew how to do everything right, we've seen her demonstrate it. Like, she's putting on a clinic of ritual and,
yeah,
you know, polite society and custom, and almost to a laughable degree. Like, I find the confrontation, like how exquisitely polite the Japanese are to each other as they're about to cut each other down, you know, mm-hmm. like, excuse me, but you can't go this way. I'm very sorry, but I can. If you please, you know, it's just great. The other thing is, I felt really blue after this episode, and obviously I was distressed because I honestly didn't have it in the cards Mariko would die. I guess I should have, because they were kind of tell, like, she's just wanting to die the entire season. That's her defining characteristic. But it still took the wind out of my sails. But I and it's one of those things that kind of stuck with me. And I realized it's not just I'm sad that Mariko's dead. I'm also kind of pre-grieving the series being over. Like, we got one more hour, man, and it's gone. And I keep on saying, well, you're going to watch the miniseries, you're going to read the book, and but yeah, like, I'm only going to have this one first experience. And thank the gods, I have not been spoiled. So I,
yeah, and they've done a great job.
Feels like a really special show.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I don't know if part of that is the novelty. I just don't see a lot of this type of show dealing with this subject matter here in the U.S.
Doesn't hurt.
And it being such high quality, I mean, obviously, you got to have that. I think they've done a great job keeping Torunaga's plan secret, because clearly he has a plan. I mean, he doesn't send Mariko to the city to kill herself unless there's a real plan here. I just don't know. Like you said, it seems more and more like Torunaga's going to win. I think if that's the case, it feels like they're building to a Pyrrhic victory here. I can't see him winning in any way that keeps his head. Unless I don't know. Unless all the lords get so pissed off about what's happening here that they go and kill Ochiba, kill Ishido, like take them out of power somehow, maybe.
If he but that seems like a contradiction. If Torunaga wins, of course he keeps his head. That was the proposition from the second episode.
No, he doesn't have to. I mean, he could show up at Osaka, they could kill him, and that could be the final blow to their
Well, then
power.
He wouldn't win. He'd be defeated.
No. he could accomplish his goal while also dying.
That's absolutely
a possibility. His goal may be to save Japan, right? And you could do that while also dying.
That's the gladiator
ending. Just like Mariko is doing here.
Yeah,
totally.
I see what you're saying. Okay. I thought you were saying that, like, he wins, because, like, man, that was a proposition from the second episode. It's like, you win, you get to write the rules and write the history books, but you got to win with your head still on your shoulders.
And I think, like, calling this episode Crimson Sky is an interesting choice, because that was supposed to be the crazy plan, that just an all-out frontal assault, and if you attack, there's one of two outcomes: you're either dead or you win that victory. This is like the Crimson Sky moment, but it's all political. None of it is like a physical attack on the castle.
Yeah, that's how I treat. But I got an alternate track of thought that I want to try on you. Is it possible that this was Crimson Sky the entire time? Because Mariko mentioned that her father came up with this plan. Now, I don't know if that's like just in the abstract of like, I want my daughter to live so she can someday be a finely tuned political weapon against my enemies, or like, I've got this exact, you know, with the regent set, but this predates any of that stuff happening. It also feels like she is doing a concrete plan. Like, this is the fate her father had in mind for her, and much more specific than just I'm meant to be some kind of weapon to avenge him. Like, this is a very, and I wonder,
she
because
she never knew that intention. She claims like she's
recently
been living a life that is completely devoid of meaning, right?
And now she's been
through Torunaga given that new intention.
I want to, because Torunaga is so secretive and so distrustful of even his own advisors that I could see him coming up with an elaborate plan for an all-out offense of Crimson Sky when his real Crimson Sky was like a much more smaller, more intimate package delivered by Mariko. And then if he is ever heard talking about Crimson Sky, or there's letters or alluding to it, and it's like, oh, well, that's just the all out frontal assault that he's rejected and his general died for. Like, I don't know. Sure. Like, it. And the way this episode's called Crimson Sky, number one, it must be a big, because I remember a big hoopla over, oh my God, the episode titles and descriptions are spoiling everything in Hulu. I haven't actually looked at that, but I wonder how much people got their kimonos in a twist worrying that they'd be spoiled. Yep. When the producers, the showrunners, and Hulu's been laughing up their sleeves the entire time.
Because this is an ironically titled episode.
It could be. But I do wonder. Yeah. I do wonder if there's other layers to it, because, you know, it's Toranaga, and
we're only going to find out, you know, after the fact. So I think it's a pretty clever naming of the episode.
Oh, yeah. It works. It works exquisitely either way. Mm-hmm. Kind of like Mariko's plan.
Yeah. Yeah. They've got us in a Zug's Wang. All right. Well, why don't we get into the recap of this episode?
Let's do it. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now, back with more Bald Move. We open up with a younger Mariko meeting Father Martin some 14 years ago at one of her lowest points, and he offers her something to cling to.
Yeah. I don't know if you call this a rosary. It's the cross necklace that she's been wearing.
I thought it was a rosary too, but I think it's just a beaded necklace.
Yeah. Maybe rosary is something you say prayers on. They probably can be one and the same, I imagine.
Yeah, big rosary. Lots of prayers.
Yeah. I don't know. Not super familiar with Catholicism.
Me either. That ignorance will be on display throughout the episode. I apologize.
Yeah. All right, here's my biggest complaint with the episode, and it's such a minor one. You got to start using some form of AI for de-aging people, because this wig and makeup stuff is not really cutting it anymore. Like, Father Martin says, I'm not much older than you. Mariko's supposed to be 14. They've obviously got the same actors playing them, and I'm like, you change their hair a tiny bit to make...
Right.
Yeah, it's I don't know.
Mariko's bangs are must. You can tell she's been running into the snow.
It's not that bad, but we've got the tech. Let's do it.
I feel like this is a pretty plausible reason for Mariko to convert to Christianity. Like, she, you know, this is a tried and true method of people coming to Christ. They're at a low point. They have nothing to cling to, nothing to believe in. They're aimless, hopeless, and someone comes in saying, saying, don't have to worry about that all this. It's all about a greater eternal reward you're looking for. And the person who, yeah, I think, and they hinted as much. There's nothing any deeper than that. She was just psychologically devastated and empty. And this is something that, you know, she was caught. She didn't know how to keep going on with this disgrace. But this, you know, her faith that God had spared her for a reason is eventually rewarded, because it turns out, yeah, no one bothered to tell her. But yeah, if you killed yourself, it really, really gonna, it's like throwing John Blackthorne's cannons into the sea.
Yeah, and we got some answers on her feelings on suicide in this episode that we've been kind of wondering about, like how much of the Christian doctrine has she really adopted in regards to that. We'll talk about that later, but I thought it was interesting how they bookended sort of Mariko's feelings about her faith here. At the beginning of the episode, you have her getting this cross and being kind of the rock that she can cling to when she's in troubled waters. And then at the end of the episode, that's destroyed, right? She rips that off, and then there's a scene where she goes to cling to it and it's not there. Mm-hmm. And you get the sense that maybe she didn't need that all along. There's some change in Mariko that's happened over the course of this episode that says reaching for that cross is not the thing she prefers or needs now.
It's a bit of a Dumbo's feather.
Yeah.
Know. Okay. I see what you're putting down there. We move on to the next scene where John Blackthorne, Yabashige, and Mariko sail into Osaka, where the black ship has returned from Macau.
Oh, man. All my theories. Best laid theories of mice and men here. Like, I was expecting them to go to Macau and get a Ronin army and mercenaries and come back and attack Osaka Castle and Crimson Sky. None of that's happening.
I was expecting at some point that the Blackthorn ship and its cannons would make its way to Osaka Bay and like long range shell the castle while they're doing a cloak rip. And that's like, I don't even see how that's possible. I don't know if that would happen. Did I believe that these men could sail the ship without Blackthorn's advice and command, and he's stuck in the castle? Like, surely they're not going to let him out now. It almost seems like Blackthorn's going to be like a Francis Scott Key type bystander to any battle that happens. He's going to be behind bars or locked behind the castle, just observing the things happening. So, yeah, I thought sure from the first episode that at some point that ship and its cannons would be the linchpin to the strategy. Maybe it was all just misdirection for all the political stuff. But
you're making a lot of assumptions in those statements, man. Everybody in that storehouse could be dead.
This is true.
Yeah, but I don't
believe so. Why would the ninjas do that? Like, they're clearly tasked with taking Mariko alive.
Seemed like it, yeah.
Why the hell would they use so much? Like, I could see blowing the door off its hinges, but why would they use so much powder that, like, because Yabashika said, oh my God, the blast will kill us all. Mm-hmm. But he's also the entire time trying to get them to surrender and fall into custody. So yeah. It could be that, no, in fact. Yeah, he's overstating it just so Mariko will break their nerve, or some of the other ladies will, and the door will be opened. And
what show has he been watching up till now, trying to get Mariko to break her will? Yeah.
Yeah, but there's all the other ladies, and crucially Blackthorn, who is an impetuous fool. So.
True.
I did love, like, Mariko is so fucking locked in this episode, and she does so many little things, like when Yabashiga is like, did you translate my words honestly? And she's like, yeah, I did. Like, what the hell? You know, it's like telling a cop, are you lying to me? You have to tell me, right?
No, and I was wondering, it was so conspicuous. I'm like, are they doing this to later bring this back? Because I don't see any other reason to really do it other than comedy, I guess.
I mean, that's good enough reason when it comes to Yabashiga, but it also allowed Mariko to show off this little, like, simultaneously spin on her heel and curtsy at the same time. She like spins and dips and kind of does her. It's just really, really giving Yabashiga exactly what he calls for.
He needs to teach that move to Blackthorn so he can
Yeah, right?
Yeah, become a master of the bow.
So our heroes are met at the gates of Osaka by Shido's men and escorted inside. Yabushiga gives instructions to Blackthorn while Mariko meets with Torunaga's wife and consort.
Yeah. Yeah, Yabu didn't understand anything that Blackthorn said. He's like, oh yeah, certainly. Certainly
it's
understand
so
that.
Funny how like the energy's kind of passed where now Yabushiga is the one who's kind of off the wrong foot and kind of acting like he knows what's going on because he doesn't want to be embarrassed, and it's Blackthorn mm-hmm. kind of enjoying his discomfort.
Yeah, I mean, he's been unmasked as sort of the fool that he is, or the lickspittle, the like the worm, all these things that, you know, he doesn't appear to be at the very beginning. He appears to be a strong, confident, powerful person. And then over the course of 9 episodes, they've just degraded him to the point mm-hmm. of almost being a fool. All he is comedy at this point.
Yeah, he's, I don't know what Clay is, but I'm pretty sure he's from the House Waffle. It's pretty funny. There's also a brief scene of Torunaga's wife and his consort, the one that just bore him a new child, and they're apologizing for the tight quarters because they got noble families just stuffed all over the castle. And she has orders for them both, and the elder lady takes the orders, kind of widens her eyes, pockets them, and says, "Let's hope this works." I don't know whether this is the Mariko gambit or this is like Mariko plus follow on Crimson Sky.
Yeah, we'll see.
Also, in another scene, the Portuguese Catholics find out that John Blackthorn is back in town, and they worry about what that means for them, for Japan, and for the future of war.
Yeah, they worrying here is just... I don't remember his name, but the higher up of the two priests here, not Father Martin.
I call him the Father Superior or the Father Visitor. He's got like a D'Artagnan type name, but I didn't write it down.
He seems to be the more perceptive of the two, for sure. He susses out that this has to be a plan by Torunaga. There is no way that man is defeated and sending these servants of his into Osaka.
You know, I confess that I'm not exactly sure what role, like, I don't know what we get by seeing this into the Portuguese position. Maybe it'll be developed in the finale and I'll finally understand. But I'm 9 episodes in and I'm not sure what the point of Father Martin in this whole thing. Like, I could have just been told by Mariko or Torunaga what the Portuguese have decided or what his spies are telling, and I gotten everything. Because, like, Father Martin, I don't get him. I don't get what makes him tick. Like, it seemed like he had an arc where he's going to get disillusioned with his faith and then essentially join Torunaga. And maybe that's still on the table, but like, boy, I feel like they've really underwritten that if he's just going to wholesale convert next episode.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it.
That if they don't play a pivotal part in the final battle, and maybe they will, it's gonna be really weird that like it's both underwritten and that it doesn't. I don't think it's doing what they need it to do for me to be involved, but also overwritten, in which it's just superfluous.
There's too much there. Yeah,
yeah. I just should have gotten rid of it.
They are kind of setting a stage where I could see Christian involvement in this final episode with the black ship there, with these priests who are concerned about Torunaga's plan, with the Christian regents who mm-hmm. have been intimately involved in the goings on at Osaka Castle the last couple episodes, and this episode in particular. I can see it. They're setting a stage, but I don't quite see exactly how it's going to all connect.
Well, that's my point, too. As we've gotten to know the Christian lords better in the last two episodes, I just don't know why we need their Portuguese masters. Like, we can accurately gauge their thought through their thoughts and actions. So,
yeah.
And again, I'm not saying that their inclusion wouldn't be beneficial. I'm just not seeing it yet.
Uh-huh.
So Yabushiga and Blackthorn are granted an audience with Ishido. But first, Kiyama tells Blackthorn that he's arrived too late to horn in on the Japanese trade.
Still with this I'm not a pirate routine.
Yeah.
And I guess now,
God damn it.
I guess at this point, he's kind of not. Like, he's so changed.
Yeah. He's a mercenary of the high seas. Merchant mercenary.
Yeah. But Yabu in this scene, you know, it's more comedy, like trying to win over Ishido with a particular bow. It's like, that's not what's going to save your skin here, man. I guess it might be a component of not insulting him and not like ruining your chances at this before they even get off the ground. But it's going to be your pitch and what you have to offer that's really going to be your saving grace, if there is any.
It seems delusional. It's along the same lines of like Breaking Bad when Skinny Pete introduced Jesse to Tuco. Like, oh yeah, I knew this guy in jail and it's going to be fine. And it wasn't fine. but also, what is he going to do? Like, Yabushiga is increasingly desperate because he's a monkey that always grabs firm hold of the next branch before he lets go of the old, and now he's in a situation where the branches are just falling of their own accord. And he's crapping out on this game of musical liege lords.
But I did love the
bowing scene.
Yeah,
just is like peak Yabushiga. He's wearing the funniest outfit. He's just fussing over Blackthorn, and his outrageous sounds of approval and disapproval. It's just
the faces he makes. I can't honestly tell a difference between the two bows. The bow he does before he's instructed and the bow after, but that's. I'm sure Ishido can.
That might be the point that Ishido is just fussing, you know?
That Yabu is? Yeah. Yeah, it could be.
Oh, yes.
He sees something wrong with it until his guy comes over and tells him how to do it right.
And I tell you what, Yabushiga's still pretty ballsy dealing with Kiyama. You know, Kiyama's like, oh, thanks for returning my prisoners. Uh-huh. Like, yeah, well, fuck you, no. And also, your Christian games are stupid and your hat looks dumb. And then he walks off like, wow, that's a crazy way to talk to a Lord Regent. If you're looking for another branch to swing from, but
as an opportunist,
is Yabu above a last minute ditch conversion to Christianity?
No, he's not above it.
He's in the white robes and he's got a dagger. He's like, wait, I just felt it. Christ entering my heart, brother. Yeah, and it's like, we need to hold a full inquiry in this. We need to get the Pope and Rome involved. This is a miracle.
Yep.
Saint Yabushiga.
He would claim that he talked to God if he thought it would help him.
Yeah, and Ishido's like, yeah, I'm going to arrange the meeting. Schnick. Uh-huh.
No, Ishido, it's interesting that Ishido seems content to keep using this tool that Yabushiga has made himself. It almost strikes me as like foolish on Ishido's part, because Yabu doesn't seem even that competent. He's like borderline competent, right? Occasionally he can get the job done, but most of the time you send him out to do a job, he sees another branch to swing from and he starts swinging from it. And he's very ineffective as an instrument, I would guess.
But he's reliable in the Toranaga sense of the word. He's reliably does the things that Yabushiga is going to do. And I imagine he's competent in terms of warrior, in terms of seems like he's highly trained, educated, does the calligraphy, is super invested in poem. He boils people on the side, but it's just that he's a loose cannon. But, Toranaga's got the psycho history down where he thinks he can and I bet that is like it would. You know, it reminds me of Martin Luther King's like letter from a southern jail where he says he kind of prefers the outright hostility of like openly racist people to like the kind of tutting he'd get from the more moderate people to be like, oh, you know, I agree with you, but do you have to do with this violence? And because it's easy, they're going to predict. You don't know when your other quote unquote allies are going to betray you, but you know your enemies are your enemies. So it's like I can kind of get Toranaga saying like I love a reliable shit face that I know is going to be a shit face than the samurai obsessed with Bushido, because who knows what they're going to do.
I think Toranaga is just way more capable in flying him from his fist, right? Where Ishido, I think Ishido tries, he just doesn't. He doesn't quite have what it takes to fly this particular bird.
Were you impressed with Kiyama, like going up to Blackthorn and bust down at Portuguese on him. I thought that
a little bit.
It revealed the depth of and seriousness and like a what a devotee of the trade is, because any businessman I think would be very uncomfortable using a translator. Like, how do I, you know, how do I know they're actually, but I don't know. I slightly respect him more this episode. Slightly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he still seems incapable in most regards, but.
He squandered most of that by ghosting Mariko during her seppuku ceremony, but what are you going to do? But his opinion is, and this might actually be true, I don't know the actual history, regardless of what happens to Japan, the fact that the English are arriving so late, he's just like, hey, you know, we got enough pirate merchants already. You got your pig and snout to the trough just too late.
Yeah, does that mean there's some, I guess, discomfort with that within the council itself? Are they pushing back against these things? Because it doesn't really seem like it from the outside, but that made me think that maybe they've been talking about it behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, he probably knows that, as a Christian lord, he probably knows the relative popularity, the unpopularity of Christianity. And that's the other thing. It's like, this is just showing that I think Ishido barely has control of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's the Toranaga of the other four remaining regions, where he's got the most men, the most power. But it's, you know, if everyone bound together against him, and that's the other problem, is like, I think he's replaced two of the lords with people who are essentially his puppets. That's Lord Ito and Saiki, Toranaga's brother. It's increasingly looking like he's not in on the joke.
Yeah.
Can we say that too? Yeah.
No, I mean, it's totally possible that there's some master plan here that's going to go off in the final episode. But yeah, I agree. It looks that way.
I also like how true John Blackthorne's character runs, because he shows the same frustration with Yabushiga's, like, polite asking, hey, can you not kill us in exchange for our service? And Ishido's not like, nah, go fuck yourself. And Yabushiga's like, okay, very well. And Blackthorne's like, that's it? That's just going to bow and leave? And he's like, oh, Engine, I just don't know. I'm like, anyway.
Yeah, this whole scene.
That was the undercard. Here's the main event. Mariko gets her audience. She came to recite poetry and kick ass, and she's all out of haiku. she embarrasses Ishido and makes him look like an idiot. And I don't know.
I mean, it's a direct challenge to his authority, and that's the intent, right? Is to show that he doesn't actually have as much authority as he thinks he has over these lords who are being held hostage here effectively, and to point out one way or another that they are being held hostage or that they're free to go, and that they, and that's immediately apparent. They explain this later in the episode, but that to me stood out. It's like this Zug Zwang approach where there is no right choice here. I mean, killing her is an offense to all the lords. Stopping her from leaving is an offense to the lords, because they're now hostages as well. And it's, you know, on the face of it now. It's just saying out loud all the things that Ishido's been doing, but doesn't want people to know he's been doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing a depiction of what's essentially a soft coup. You've got your traditional coup, the hard coup, where like the military rolls in and takes charge of the palace or the capital and just takes things over. And you've got like the more common soft coup, which is where people get band together as a faction and they use legitimate powers of the state illegitimately, or powers that they don't actually, they're there, but they don't have the authority to use. And
sure, but challenging.
And they take advantage of confusion and not knowing whose side what's on. And everyone just kind of goes along, because the first one that steps up and says, are you fucking cooing? It could turn into a hard coup and you die. And that's Ishido is trying to thread that needle of like, I'm not a jailer. Everyone's free to go.
But keeping
except
that
for people
fear
who have
there.
Tried to go and have met with bad ends at bandits, and you don't want to do that. It's
that's
dangerous
the
outside
thing.
Here.
At every turn this episode, I'm thinking, well, bandits are going to get Mariko on the road. It's
100%. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. The bandits thing is almost a joke at this point in the show. And I just thought he's going to let him go and then bandits are going to get him. And that's a twofold thing, right? He can simultaneously say, well, I didn't hold her here against her will. And yet everyone will silently know he killed them. And he's pawning it off on these bandits, right? He's using them as a scapegoat. And they'll be too afraid to actually exercise the right that he claims that they have.
Yeah, if all the lords and ladies get their courage in ones and twos, then he can continue to, you know, take care of that. But if they all stood up as ones because of some affront or outrage, I don't know that he could stop them all. I don't think Ishido's that powerful, especially if he's got Torunaga waiting outside the gates with a Crimson Sky Part 2. I don't know. But yeah, like I saw some people like struggling to understand the political situation. I was like, what's their get? And if you don't get it, like Lady Ochiba lays it out in the middle of the episode. Yeah. Like this is the horns of the dilemma that he's on. He can appear weak or he can appear like a tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, the other nobles are going to probably eat him alive. So.
Here's my question, though. And the one thing that was still puzzling me about Torunaga's plan. Let's say Ishido realizes that he's in a horns of a dilemma here. He decides, well, I don't want all these people to think they're hostages, so I let them go. What does Torunaga get out of that as far as an advantage in this battle to come or assumed battle to come?
So I think Torunaga's theory is there's so much division in the council and Ishido so overstepped his bounds that if the other lords felt like they were free to break with him and support Torunaga, they might.
Yeah.
And there's also sense. Like the other thing I think I'm this is something that I'm what do you call that? I'm surmising. I don't know this, but I'm surmising from the show is that just like in Game of Thrones, it's not just the great houses that matter. Like every one of them have, you know, like look at Torunaga. We've got Yabushiga. We've got Buntaro. We had Hiramatsu. Like there's lots of powerful factions within that one faction. Yeah. So like, you know, if Kiyama and Ono are true blue for Ishido for whatever reason, we know they're not really. They don't like him and they're increasingly disliking him and thinking they're in a bad deal. But they're now outnumbered on the new council and they don't want to stick their necks out. If you could get like some of their bannermen underneath that being like, you know, this ain't right. And this is offense to your Christian Lord. And I think that's the hope is that. Because they don't have everyone in the castle, right? It's all of like the noble hostages, and if enough of them were able to be free and get out, I think there would be some hostility. But again, I don't, because like there's the heir, and that's another thing I don't quite understand. And you know, who loves the heir, and who's rotten to protect the heir, and who's just using them as a ploy. There's a lot of things I don't understand, but that's kind of what I'm. Does that make sense or?
Oh, yeah. No, I think so. Okay. And Ishido's, you know, security here, his real ability to continue doing the things he's doing, which might be offensive to some people, is that he has a hostage from basically every noble family across the board here in Osaka. And if they're free to leave, he no longer has that and no longer has his security because now the city can be attacked without losing family members, you know?
Exactly. I just love this. I came to appreciate after multiple watches that Mariko's first verse is talking about herself.
Yeah.
Leafless branch, they made a big deal out of her being the last of her father's line of this noble samurai that go back to thousands of years. That seems unlikely. I don't think the samurai existed for over 1,000 years, but, you know, it's... she's just legendary family and it's going to be extinguished here in this battle. And she's the leafless branch.
And it really comes into focus even more so with the next a couple scenes from now with her son. I mean, that's the leafless branch scene to me. Like, whew, that's a rough one.
I really like Mariko employing the classic Skylar White / Sovereign Citizen defense of, am I being detained?
Yeah.
Am I being detained or am I free to go? You know?
Yeah.
And her whole speech where, you know, Ishido's like, you know, Chiba tries to kind of like, oh, let's talk about this in private. I will not. And Ishido's like, the matter is settled. The matter is settled. I am not a peasant to be trodden on. That whole speech she fires off about her being from a great line of samurai and I come and go as I please. And then, again, the backside of this is also how... exactly correct she is, the way she moves, the precision of it, her steps, the way she bows, the right time to rise and turn. She's just putting on a clinic of
And her
proper etiquette and behavior here.
Especially in her wording of things, she is saying exactly the right things about duty in order to not technically offend the Lord here, the Regent, who would, you know, potentially have cause to have her head if she were to speak to him this way in any context other than duty. And that's like, it also has this effect of putting Ishido on the spot, because Ishido doesn't expect Mariko to come in here and do this.
No, he does not.
Knowing that Ochiba is kind of the true power behind the scenes here, the Oz of it all, like, I think that's intentional, because she knows that Ochiba can't speak up in this moment, because she can't be perceived to be the one actually pulling the strings and running the show here.
Especially now that Ishido... like the property of Ishido now. Like, she's either married or betrothed. I'm not sure which.
Oh, potentially. I didn't know if she ever said yes to that.
Well, Mariko congratulated her, but I can't remember if she said betrothal or wedding or engagement.
Okay.
But yeah, she's especially now fenced in because officially in Japanese society, she shouldn't be talking at all in this, you know, outside
she's
of her.
Technically property.
Yeah.
But that puts Ishido on the spot. And I think Ishido is the one you want to talk to here, because he's the more easily confused. He's the less prepared to deal with this. He's going to have to take this conversation to his council chambers or whatever in order to get any guidance. This conversation is going to happen in front of all of these other lords who are going to see Ishido floundering and this challenge to his authority and get ideas, right?
And you can hear the murmuring. And it works as such a great counterpart to Yabushiga, because Yabushiga folds like a cheap suit in 30 seconds. And Mariko stands strong, proud, and tall, like will not, cannot relent. It's such a great contrast. And you got to wonder if Toranaga intended this as a 1-2 punch. I'm going to send Yabushiga. Well, I'm not going to send Yabushiga. Yabushiga's going to send himself, because that's who he is. And he's going to get crumpled and ragdolled. And then Mariko is going to go up there and go off. And you can just, like you said, you can tell this is like a Perry Mason courtroom as she's walking out. Because everybody's like, walla, 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 just murmuring among
themselves.
And
then they all show up watching on the walls as she's leaving later, right?
It's that great advertisement for the Defiance, too. And like, I also, through this whole scene, Lady Ochiba's eyes are as big as dinner plates, and I don't think she blinks once. It is an unsettling performance she's giving. Because I think she sees the danger here, unlike any other men.
Happening.
She knows the power Mariko has in this place and this time.
Yep, absolutely.
You know who completely is lost in tall grass? It's Yabushiga. He can't fathom what she's up to, what Lord Toranaga is trying to do. Meanwhile, Blackthorn is just mainly concerned with her safety. I really like that line. You would walk into the sword to demonstrate that it's sharp.
Yeah, get with the program, man. This is how they've shown their behavior to be throughout this entire 9 weeks.
Plus Blackthorn, like, it's I think he gets there by the end, but at this he's just thinking with his heart and maybe his penis. Because like it was clear to me that like this only works if Mariko's ready to go through with it. And she's legendarily at this point ready to go through with it, right? Like that's the, like, everyone knows this about her, that she wants to die
especially Ochiba, which is why it really works.
Yes, it really sells it.
And then
Yabushiga also
asks,
go ahead.
I was gonna say, Mariko asks Jonathan Blackthorn, can you please if you love me, for God's sake, just not involve yourself in this. And the answer is no, of course not. John Blackthorn can never not involve himself.
But he does it in a pretty good way at the end. But I have in my notes where she's like, John, can you just not? Because he's, every episode is like, does this man have a history of just nodding ever?
No. No, he's not.
But, and also Yabushiga, this freak out of his, where he's calling her crazy, and he's like, and this body of yours, is it stupid? Like, I imagine it has to sound more clever in Japanese, but the very English translation, he's just sputtering. He's, you know, Plus, he's dealing with something she's everything he's not.
Yeah.
You
devoted
know?
To a cause. Yeah. Really, yeah. That's it.
Maintaining
calm.
And also maintaining fragile alliances and loyalties impeccably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like everything subordinate to her lord, even Jesus Christ and John Blackthorne. But she also tries to be fair in each one of those, doesn't want to. Yeah. And yeah, it's just great. And it's so funny.
Yeah. And I love the setup back in episode one of Yabushige, because he styles himself this student of death and nature and just like,
yes,
almost a philosopher warrior, right? And then you get
philosopher
progressively,
Edward, maybe, but yeah,
sure, sure. I mean, you know, death is part of life, and
true.
He studies it,
and he also, don't forget, when he was about to drown, he was gonna kill himself. Like he does believe in some principles.
He does, but also, I wonder if any of that stands at this point, because he's so far from that character that we're introduced to. And I think they've done it really naturally and a really good job of it. He's just getting more and more desperate. And he's a man who, I guess, is not very articulate in his own death here. Or I don't know. It's weird because, yeah, you point out when he goes over the cliff there, he's ready to take his own life in very honorable and brave fashion. But like here, he's doing everything he can to avoid death. Groveling and demeaning himself, and
that's what I kept thinking of, that phrase that like a man who tailors himself to other men's expectations will never suit themselves, that like as Yabushige continues to like carve off pieces of his honor and his nobility to avoid this death that he's fixated on, like there's episode three, Yabushige could have, you know, at the sunrise followed Toranaga and become an honorable samurai. When he stole Toranaga, he could, like, there's many, many signposts where he could have been like, even when, you know, I think he impressed Mariko in the last episode by refusing John's initial overtures of, hey, let's you and me be pirates or privateers. But he's just lost. He can't do anything but sputter and bemoan the face of a true samurai. So also just him not being able to resist insulting her poetry on the way off. And then another thing, this leafless branch, shit poem, honestly. It's very, almost like Austin Powers. Honestly, who writes about a leafless branch in the spring? So next scene is Mariko's son meeting with her to warn her of the consequences for bringing dishonor onto their and his family.
That is a rough one. Word to all wise young people out there, don't make promises that you don't understand the full impact of. This kid is making a vow to disown her if she escapes the city. I don't think he fully understands what he's dealing with here. He can't. I mean, we don't fully understand as viewers. I don't even know if Mariko herself understands, you know, what, but she knows that Toranaga has a plan and she's part of it. And I don't think this kid fully appreciates the family history here and the dynamic that he's dealing with. I know he gets called names and stuff because of who his grandfather was. But disavowing your mother because she is trying to preserve and reclaim the dignity and honor of her family is a really stupid thing to do.
Yeah. I wonder if
Mariko's
even tried.
I get the feeling that everybody's in his ear. You know, I mean, Kiyama has been trying to appeal to God through him, to Mariko and her faith, and like offering marriage alliances to this kid, right? I feel for him because he's just a naive young child, but like, it makes me sad seeing it. Mariko's reaction to it is particularly
rough. Kills her. You can tell, like, this, like, him talking about dishonoring her family is something that she's, but the thing is like, I don't even know if Mariko's ever tried to defend herself. It feels like very much a Jaime Lannister Kingslayer deal, where it's like there's an explanation but no one wants to hear it, and she's like, you know, she's
defensive.
Not gonna demean herself by like, oh, if you just understand my daddy. It's like, because no one's gonna care, no one's gonna understand.
But this is like the true leafless branch moment for her. I feel so bad for her. Like, you know, she does have the son, and that family could live on, especially if she can, through some plan the Toranaga has, reclaim her dignity and her honor for her family. Her son might be able to take advantage of that. But here he's threatening to disown her if she does that. And it's like,
That's a good... I wonder if the family line only passes through the father, because
it's not
strictly speaking that she's the last of the line if she has a living heir. But like I said, it might only go through the father's name. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, unless you have a male heir, do you even have anything?
Right.
So she made a big splash here. And as a result, the next morning, it seems like the whole town has shown up on top of the walls, the ramparts of Castle Osaka, and to see the defiance of Mariko. She resolutely approaches the gates to leave the town guarded by an armed escort.
I love this back and forth here, the tension that they've created between Mariko leaving and them stopping her, but not wanting to actually harm her in the process. Because then they do really look like the tyrants, right? If they can just turn her away, like break her will, and she chooses not to go, that's a victory for them. But she's too resolved for that. And when she's unable physically to get through this blockade they've set up, she decides, I think in another Zeg Swang moment, to take her own life at sunset.
Yeah, have I already talked about this in the podcast, or was I gushing about this pre-podcast? I just thought, like, this is obviously a depressing scene, but Mariko's samurai, the first guy especially that she orders to cut this man down, and he goes and bows to those guys, and he just kind of sits there waiting like a gunslinger. And the guy goes for a sword, and he gets like 6 inches out. And then I watched this so many times. He like cuts that dude's fingers off. So he drops the sword, opens up the other dude's belly, and then comes back. And that was on the draw stroke, by the way. His sword's in this in the sheath. He draws it, takes the dude's fingers out, guts the other guy, and then comes back for the first guy's neck. And it's over in a half a second. And he flicks the blood off and then returns it. It's just... God damn, it looks cool. It looks really cool.
It does. And imagine standing there as one of these guys with these spears or whatever they've got, watching that happen, right? You've got no armor. You're wearing essentially pajamas, and this knight in shining armor here comes up with his sword, where he's just murdered two people in a half second.
Yeah.
That's
terrifying. They're like, well, he's got armor, but maybe he's not skilled. Oh, shit. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there are 9 more of him behind that guy, you know?
I wondered about all those guys. Like, even Ishido's men showed real courage, because you can kind of see after that happens, and they kind of grip their staffs and their spears, and they're like, well, okay. And they all kind of charge, and...
You can see the fear in their face, too. Like, they're scared of it, but they're going to do their duty anyway.
And I started to think, like, okay, they're not... Because I remembered the other thing is, I love seeing Mariko standing there like this lone island as the waves crash around her and just all this violence is swirling around her. And I kept noticing, okay, it's like she's not going to win here, but she's whittled them down to like 2 or 3 guards. I think Mariko can take him with her sword staff, Naginata. And then as I'm thinking that, the gate opens and like 20 more dudes with spears come in and... I could almost, like, this isn't Blue-Eyed Samurai. There's no way Mariko's going to take out
no
18 dudes with spear and staff. And she tries. She just can't get it done. And you know, she just really, the screaming, the yelling, the rage, she's like, all of her impotent anger that has built up in her chest, as Ochiba says later, has built up, and she just gets to let it all out before she crumples. And it's almost funny the way she's like, these fucking men, there's too many of them. I gotta go back to my
bedroom. It almost feels like a little performative there.
And 100%.
It is, but in what way? Because there are 2 ways that this could be performative. One, it definitely is. Like, to all these other lords, she wants to declare that she has been unable to do her duty because these men prevented her from it. They are bad men, and they are Ishido's men. So they want that, you know, blow to Ishido's reputation. But then she also kind of... she's appealing to Kiyama specifically as one of the regents and his Christian faith, forcing him to kind of be her second here, be involved in this, get
He's personally got to get involved.
Because their faith, the Christian faith, says that if I kill myself and there's no one there to second me, my soul is eternally damned.
I was wondering about that, that's how the little loophole for the seppuku loophole.
Seems
that,
like it, yeah.
I just stuck a knife in my belly. Technically, that didn't kill me. It was the decapitation stroke. Yeah. Hey, man, there's lots of loopholes and lots of religious things.
You can twist it however you want. But I thought it was a particularly interesting twist to get this regent personally involved.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it does really make me wonder. Forking them.
Let's say Mariko just keeps shuffling toward the gate. How far does she get before they start physically restraining her? Because they're just reticent to even touch her.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Japanese police take down a guy like with a crazy person with a knife?
No.
They've got these enormous like tuning fork deals that have like these long sticks.
Are they
like with
the zombie?
No, they're like
they're
big enough for a whole
dead
body, and like five or six will surround and hook you, and then you're just kind of stuck in this wooden hoop. I think they kind of do that with the spears.
Okay.
You know? But like you know, Mariko's wanting, because you said like how much of this performative? It's as performative as a football player taking a dive when
as
a blade
Reggie
of grass
Miller
touches their shin, as
Reggie
Miller
shot,
taking an elbow
legs
that whiffed 3 feet away from him. Oh, it's like they're trying to draw the foul. They want as many of those nobles to be shocked and offended, because that's the other thing is if you haven't gotten already that Mariko is like this almost semi-mythical figure, like she is from this long distinguished line of samurai. Yeah, her dad disgraced herself, but still that almost adds to her mystique, and she's been a Christian, and the only way she hasn't been able to survive
for the Minowara, like
working for the Minowara, and the only reason she's able to survive is because she is so perfect. If she was anything less, she would be drug and canceled essentially by the Japanese society at the time. And this is supposed to be a shocking affront to let the lords and ladies who have preserved their honor by saying, well, we're not hostages, we could leave at any time. Well, why don't you ask to leave? I don't want to leave. I like Asako. It's to get them off their fucking off the fence and into the game. And I think
they've done a great job setting all this up to where we understand all the stakes. We understand the machinations going on here, the calculations.
Yeah. And we see that, like, I don't know how the other nobles are taking it, but this business has really divided the council. We see the scene where Ono and Kiyama are kind of like, this is dangerous. And Ochiba explains the impossible political position Mariko has forced them into.
Yeah.
That
which this is
you either appear weak and get walked over, or you appear a tyrant and get overthrown.
It's for the kids in the back who weren't really paying attention, who were on their phones. They're just explaining the details here. I want to jump back real quick. Sorry, I didn't fully talk out this other scene. There's a moment here where Mariko realizes the futility of this and is still fighting. She's still tilting at this windmill, right? But she's working through a little bit of her shit here. She's just screaming and flailing and raging against the machine here. And I really felt that on a personal level for her in that scene. It's something that like 100%. Turns from very professional and very like mannered into something ugly and resentful. I loved it.
Yeah, it's ferocious.
Mm-hmm.
I really like going back to this council scene where, you know, Chiba lays all out. That's like, you're wrong. She is motivated by vengeance on fate, on all of us. She wants to die. She wants to be free of her disgrace. And then it'll damn us all. And Saiki says, oh, I think that's a bit extreme. And she doesn't even respond. She just kind of slowly opens her fan. I kind of like, you know, like, oh, fuck, you know. I tried telling you. You won't be told.
It seems like the only option here is to get her to do neither, right? To not allow her to leave, but also not allow her to die. And there doesn't seem a path forward for that.
because she's ready to die. It's not a bluff.
Yeah.
If it was a bluff, they could do this, but she's got all the cards here. And we can start, there's also hints that the other nobles are, she's gaining some ground because a bunch of noble ladies approach to Tycho's widow and ask if they can't, no, I'm sorry, not to Tycho's widow, Toranaga's chief wife, and ask if they could be present for Mariko's ceremony. They're showing, they're offering her critical support.
They said that they left with Toranaga earlier, and then maybe they felt a little bit of guilt around that, like they abandoned them.
There's probably a lot of, because I think that the Tycho's widow's words on Ishido, probably a lot of these nobles feel like this guy's just a fucking peasant farmer. And now look, and he's holding, I've been a samurai house for 800 years. Who's this guy's out in a rice paddy before our Lord plucked him for war and amused him as a squire, and there's got to be resentment, and that's with leaving outside the, you know, there's that great scene where Ishido pissed off every single member of the council. He's like, oh no, you're a disease-ridden freak, you know, just by rejecting their retainers, you're a Christian crazy fundamentalist, you're a greedy little bitch, and the council was always like kind of a powder keg. Obviously these are ambitious, powerful men, forced to share power, but there's probably a lot of anger and resentment towards we last saw, Shigeyama, like he just said fuck this, I'm out, and got killed for it. So I bet a lot of lords wanted to do that. They were just afraid that would happen.
You really just need to shake the hold that Ishido has for a moment, and it'll all unravel.
Yeah. And then not let him get away with the bandit bullshit. It's a roundabout. Right. Like, you know, like this is the thing. It has to be public. It can't be, you can't give Ishido plausible deniability.
Yeah. Which makes me, I have some questions at the end of this episode around that.
Yeah.
We'll talk about them. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
So the heir summons Blackthorn to his side for an audience, but turns out it's merely a sham for Achiba and Mariko to spar over their lives, legacy, and the meaning of duty.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if this is Ochiba's sort of desperate attempt to pull on the heartstrings of Mariko here and win some kind of victory that way. Maybe she can get her to change her mind if she can appeal to their childhood and that kind of stuff. But obviously it doesn't work. It almost backfires on her. Like, she says all this stuff about their childhood and how amazing she was, and then Mariko just kind of reflects it back, and it seems to stick to Mariko more, or to Ochiba more.
It's honestly a great way to deal with manipulation. You know, it's a very judo approach. And she finally flips it out of the end, you know, about you're the one playing games. But yeah, I don't know, because like that's the thing. It's like these women are interesting because they're almost two sides to the same coin. They're both women who were greatly impacted by the deaths of their father, the extrajudicial deaths at that, and they're both completely incapable of reconsidering their way of dealing with that. Like, Achiba's all about number one and protecting my line. Guys, without the heir, I'm nothing. I'm worth nothing. And I'll have, you know, accounted for nothing. And I've lost, and I've scratched back what I've gotten. And, you know, Mariko obviously is set on her path as well, resolutely. So it's, I don't know, it felt like two sisters who've been estranged coming together over, like, the funeral of a loved one and then realizing, oh, yeah, there's a reason we don't speak to each other anymore. There's nothing left to say.
Sure. Yeah, there's also this tinge of the stuff that the madam at the tea house was talking about, too, which is this iron grip of the patriarchy here over their lives. Mm-hmm. And Ochiba, I mean, that's Mariko's appeal here. Like, you are the one who has the best chance of doing anything about that, and yet you seem to be just working within the system as defined. And that's the thing that strikes Ochiba, right?
And it's also reinforced by the fact that they both acknowledge that we were best friends. We were like sisters. What drove us apart is the wars and enmities of men. Yeah. I didn't have a problem with you. You didn't have a problem with me. But now we're against each other on the battlefield because of the fucking dudes, man.
And it's a freaking mountain to climb, because, like, Ochiba rightly says, like, even as someone who has maybe the most power in the entire country, she's still sort of semi-powerless to really do anything about it. It's not something that just one person can change. Even no matter how powerful they are, they're gonna have to spend a lot of time and effort and then win some mind share here, because they just can't decree it.
I'm not sure I fully understand the meaning, or if I agree with the philosophy, the flowers are only flowers because they fall.
My notes say, in quotes, flowers are only flowers because they fall. Okay, whatever, lady. I really don't know what it means.
Like,
there are a couple of times.
Fall, are they flowers too? Like, it's, sure, I think the thing is like, the something only has beauty because it's fleeting.
Yeah, death is part of life, that kind of thing. Yeah,
right. But it's just a weird, like, even if you want to go with that, it's like, well, is a mountain not beautiful? Is the ocean not beautiful? Like, on human scales, they might as well be eternal. Like, you know, it's not just the fleeting. Mm-hmm. I mean, that can, but maybe she's talking about just purely humans. The only thing that makes us beautiful is that we our lives. But I don't know. It's another one where it's like, I struggle to quite understand this blasé attitude towards, which I understand, as I've been reading, is not quite historical, or if it is, so it's, you know, like, we're preoccupied with death in the West too. Don't believe me? Battle of Thermopylae, 300, Charge of the Light Brigade, the Alamo. We fucking love a tragic, inevitable death that men go into with clear eyes, wide open, in the service of a greater thing. It's just, we don't talk about it the exact same way because our stuff is tinged by our culture and our traditions, just like, but it's like, you know, it's essentially the same. You would find no shortage of people in any given side of any given war willing to go on a suicide mission if it's going to mean accomplishing their, I mean, they're not going to do it just for nothing, but even still, it is a struggle to get inside the head of Mariko.
Yeah.
And Blackthorn struggles too. He tries to talk Mariko out of taking her own life, but she's adamant that her life and death must have a purpose.
How many times are you gonna have this conversation? For God's sake, I hope it's the last. If Mariko survives somehow the end of this episode,
there's no fucking shot.
I don't think so, but you never know. But my God, the guy is dense, man. He just doesn't get it. Mariko has never wavered from this stance, and no matter how many times you plead with her, it's not going to change it, man.
Yeah, but like, man, to be in love with a woman like that, like, you wouldn't you try, like, on the eve of, like, okay, sure. We haven't actually, we've been talking like we don't mean anything to each other, and I'm mine, and you're yours, and you go your way, and I go mine, but I do love you, and I want to put that out there in case it's enough.
It's never been enough. It's still not enough. Yeah.
Yeah. And she does. She takes his hand and doesn't even respond. Just kind of looks at him with like almost pity that, like, I'm so sorry. You can't understand that, you know, life. And that is, I do understand that, like, the life and death are kind of the same. Both can have value and purpose. That's true enough. But
you're
right.
Blackthorn is only made if she does die for it. Like, that's the thing.
This is all just cheap. It is cheap theatrics, except for what elevates it to expensive, refined theatrics is her willingness to go through with it. If this is just a sham, that's what made Hiramatsu's death meaningful too. It was also a charade, and I think he knew that at the moment of his death. But, like, the fact that it happened is what keeps the generals in line. The fact that this is going to happen is what's going to shock the senses of the nobility and weaken Ishido on the eve of Crimson Sky, potentially. So
I want to revisit real quick Hiramatsu's suicide, because to me, that has less effect. Now that Martine has gone back and said, hey... But that was a naked ploy, obviously. I mean, it must just be for his own men at that point, like, to bring them back around.
I think because Torunaga apparently fears a spy he doesn't know. I mean, fair enough. But he can't tell the generals, look, guys, wink, wink, we're going to go surrender, wink, because then if they start drinking in their cups and they're talking to the wrong courtesan, mm-hmm. and Ishido gets this, and they, you know, this might only work if they're completely undefended, and or if Ishido's distracted by, I don't know, some internal domestic strife. He had to die because, like, he can't tell his generals, hey, I'm biding my time, just wait. But they have to be shamed by a man that they all revere and fear and admire, like the greatest of them. And as he dies, he looks right at them and says, you better be faithful to our Lord, goddammit. Yeah. That
Martine
made a big impression.
So the Martine angle is the thing I don't understand about it. Like, sending Father Martine with this, you better go back and tell everybody how broken of a man I am. And then he goes back and it's just immediately discarded because everybody knows Torunaga is not a broken man. What?
But Ishido, if Ishido buys it, and I think that's the important thing, is Ishido, maybe now Mariko, he's starting to cotton on that something's up. But I don't know, man. Ishido might just at this point be like, Torunaga's trying to be something in death. He's trying to take advantage of his son's death. He's trying to take advantage of a conjugal visit with his woman. He's wanting to see his grand, like, you know, like Ishido don't give a fuck when Mariko's like, oh, he's mourning his son. He's got others. Like, but
I don't know, this almost like reveals too many of his cards, but I mean, at some point you have to reveal your cards, so I'm sure this plays right into his plan.
Yeah, and what you say and what you do also matters, and Torunaga, like, the actual doing here, I think, is a lot, you know, like killing this very great noble lady by a direct attack inside the capital, when, like, even if Ishido tries to say, oh, it's ninjas, what are you going to do? A black mark that he can't protect people inside his own fucking castle. Are you kidding me?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah, it's not going to be believable. It's like he's either incompetent or he's corrupt. And it's almost worse to be incompetent than corrupt, you know?
Either way, he shouldn't be leading the country.
Right. So Yabushiga, meanwhile, gets an offer he can't refuse from Ishido as Mariko attempts to confess her sins to Father Martin.
Is it worth it, Yabu? Is it worth it at this point? You're going off to one more desperate branch.
I think Yabushiga answers that with a wary, in this actual scene.
He sure does.
What'd you make of JB here drawing in the Zen Garden, defacing it?
He sees the chaos of the world. He sees none of it makes sense to him, right? Get this beautiful order, and he's just like, no, there's no beautiful order here. It's all horrible.
It's a big moment of character development, because like I think he does it petulantly, like, you know, he's seeing this madness in his eyes and he can't do anything about it. And then he looks at this ordered garden, which is essentially the visual representation of this rigid system that he's raging against. Mm-hmm. And he goes and defaces it. But it becomes something else. Like, I think it
he looks at it
and it's like, that's me. I'm the flaw in the order. I have been going against the flow this whole time. I think this is one of the things that helps him kind of surrender to Mariko's fate.
Yeah, and then makes him step up to be her second here in a few scenes.
And I don't know, there's a really nice symmetry between Father Martin, her being feeling unworthy to confess, and him like, I'm kind of unworthy to hear it because I don't got an altar and I've got the vestments. This is just all, you know, not proper. And she's like, well, let's just drink an empty cup of tea to mark our time and how little we have left, which is, it's got a lot of layers of meaning now that we know what the tea ceremony means for these people. The fact that you're going to go through like a dumb show of tea, drinking tea.
Yeah. This is the kind of thing that I'm just like, I'm not built for that. Somebody suggests we drink an empty cup of tea. I'm like, let's fill the cup of tea and at least enjoy it and make it memorable and meaningful. Going through the motions of a ritual just to signify your dedication, I'm not into that.
I can see it, that it's like, there's no point.
I understand it. I just can't. I wouldn't be able to actually do it.
You want your cuppa. I get it.
I just want, some kind of sensory input here that is beyond lifting a cup to my mouth.
And he decides to chant, I think, a Latin litany. Is that what you'd call it? A litany? A homily? A litany? This is where my Catholicism fails me, because I'm not.
I don't know.
Preparations are made for Mariko's suicide. We see the ladies gather to witness her final act. And Blackthorn volunteers to act as her second after Lord Kiyama punks out.
Man, you skipped the most quizzical of all of these scenes. Drum guy. What the hell is up with drum guy?
He is. So my question is this just like evening time bell? Or is this like Mariko, lady, is killing herself?
I can't imagine Ishido would allow an announcement to go out about that.
He might not have a choice. Like, this is such a ritual...
Think
and
so
highly defined that if the ritual called for drums to be played, like, I don't think he could deny it. It'd be like not letting her commit seppuku. Like,
I assumed it was sunset drums, but I don't know if you need sunset drums every day. You can look in the sky and see, oh, it's sunset. Maybe there's some ritual that happens around sunset that you would need drums to announce.
I lived by a church for a long time, and I didn't need a fucking bell every hour on the hour, much less 12 at midnight and noon, but by God, I got them.
True. True. Got some weird customs here, too.
So, I don't know. This is, I just really thought, like, what is her son thinking? I really like the detail of her tying her legs together. Apparently, that's a Japanese... woman's addition to seppuku, so that they wouldn't accidentally become unbecoming in death. Their legs wouldn't open, or they'd do anything revealing. They would die ladylike.
What's with Kiyama?
I think Ishido. It's interesting because surely he knew Ishido was going to shut the whole thing down, right? Is that why he didn't show up? He just didn't bother.
Maybe.
I still think that's an insult.
I felt like I felt like this was a particular insult to, because he's not a real Christian, right? He's a traitor. He's,
I mean,
T-R-A-D-E-R.
Is Joel Osteen a real Christian? I think Ikiyama does believe in Jesus Christ, but
okay,
he believes in the almighty dollar at least as much.
At least as much. I guess mean, the he almighty tells people yin. Like I'm not really Christian. I'm a traitor. Yeah, T-R-A-D-E-R.
Well, he didn't say he's not a Christian. Like, he just doesn't involve himself in matters of faith, which means he's like, I'll let the fathers figure out what everything means. I just believe in Jesus. That's all that's required.
But this is, I mean, a monumentous moment for Mariko when Kiyama doesn't show up. Kiyama proves that he's not actually a man of God, because if he were, he would be here, hell or high water, to make sure that her soul is not eternally damned. And he's effectively ensuring that it will be by not being there.
Is that why she breaks off the cross?
Yeah.
Or is it to not dishonor the cross?
I mean, like she's tearing it off. If she didn't want to dishonor it, she could have taken it off.
Yeah, and she could have done it with reverence and put it to side, because I could see saying that, like,
I mean,
I'm committing a mortal sin against God. I don't want to do it with a cross on my breast. But
sure,
you're right, it seemed a little bit more angry and vindictive.
Yeah, like this doesn't mean much to me anymore.
So it looks like she's ready to go through with it with no second. So she'll be damned. Mm-hmm. The other thing, I guess, is Kiyama's. Maybe this is Ishido and Ono impressed upon him that, like, look, if there's any hope of her not going through with this, she's got to believe she's going to be damned. And she does
sure
believe that. So, like, if you give her the easy way out, then so it could have been that, too.
Yeah, no, I think that's right on. That's the last. They're hoping that will be the last straw that breaks Mariko.
And John Blackthorne stepping forward to be like, I'll be your second, is the biggest declaration of love on the show yet. Like, this is,
yeah,
I'll dare say, agape love. That he is doing this unselfishly. This is not what he wants, but he knows it's what she wants and what she needs. And even though it's going to hurt him badly to do it, he's going to do it for her.
I think it's going to hurt her badly, too. This is a man who's going to take 9 chops to get the head off. He is not
well,
a swordsman.
Reading between the lines, I think she wants that, because and in Seppuku,
oh,
you kind of could negotiate
with
your second about, like, because the second without otherwise ask, I guess, would usually go to kill
how
you
many
as
chops
soon as
would
you made
like
the cut.
Like lumps in a tea?
No, but some samurai who are really committed to doing the seppuku is like, I want to be able to disembowel myself. Don't cut me, or wait until I fall. Like, she specifically says, mm-hmm, wait until I've fallen before you. So she's going to completely stab and disembowel. Or I'm not sure if the female samurai stabs her heart. I don't know if they actually disembowel themselves, but she wanted to go through with it, mm-hmm, by her own hand and at the last minute. So she wants this to be an ordeal. She doesn't want this to be,
sure,
because I guess at some point in the late Edo period, like, it got so ritualized that they didn't even have a dagger. It was just a fan, and the samurai would reach for a fan.
Oh, my
and then
God.
The guy, yeah, well, there's a lot of
samurai
opinions on all that. Yeah, the soft samurai. But that's
what I thought. It was instructive. I thought it was like, this is how the ritual is performed, you rube. Like,
mm-hmm,
how many seppukus, mm-hmm, has he seen? One, maybe?
Right. But I gotta say, the way Ishido shows up at the last minute felt almost like a game show or a hidden camera type deal.
Yeah.
Or it's like, he just comes up and says, like, oh, you stupid woman, here's your travel permits. Da 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 da. And the other thing is, like, did she feel relief, or was she feeling,
I thought so,
destroyed? Because if she feels relief, that says something, right? That says something.
Yeah, I think she's changed by this experience. Because to me, I read it as relief. Relief that she didn't have to kill herself. And that's a realization for her, because the entire time she has thought she wanted to die, I think this changed her mind.
Do you think Blackthorne's act is what did it? Or do you think just, like, looking at...
Partially.
Like, there's a lot of things there. There's her son. It's like staring her at her like he's, you know, he was talking big and bad about her preserving the honor. Now she's doing it. He's not so sure.
Yeah, I mean, her words should be ringing in her ear here about life and death being having similar values. You know, I mean, this death that she's about to perform has a big value.
True.
She's spared of it. Now, does she carry that in and say her life now has a big value? Because that's how I'm kind of reading it.
Going back to the sun angle, I do think Ochiba scored a point when she says, well, how are you going to, you know, my whole life is to protect my son. How are you going to protect yours with a sword in your heart?
Yeah.
And that's when that pissed Mariko off. She's like, it's time to go. That one scored home. So you got to think when she's standing there looking at her son, as much as she wants to die, as much as she wants to serve her lord, as much as she wants to avenge her father, as much as she wants to force Ishido, that's her son. And this is going to be difficult for him, to say the least. So,
yeah.
I mean, what's his and Buntero's life like after this? You know, if she dies. I don't know.
I don't know. I will admit, I kind of lost a little bit of track of motivations in these scenes. I think it was a little hard to follow for me as an outsider in this culture. But
yeah,
I think I'm like piecing it together well enough. And I could absolutely be wrong on some of my assumptions.
So that night, Blackthorn steals into Mariko's room and romances her.
Let me say this. The other important point in that scene, I think, is also after Ishido shows up and delivers those permits, other people immediately say, we want to apply for our permits as well.
Oh, yes. Every
so this
lady
is
in
the,
there.
Right? This is Mariko's plan coming to fruition. Toranaga's plan. Like, he's breaking the hold that Ishido has on all these hostages.
Mm-hmm. But Ishido's got one last card to play, because that night Blackthorn steals into Mariko's room and romances her up while the nobles are outside celebrating what they think is their moral victory. But alas, Ishido and Lord Shitface have other plans.
Yeah, man. Wow. What another tense scene.
I really like how detached Mariko feels from the nobles. Like, she's looking at them drinking sake, enjoying the victory that she's won, and she just is empty. And then JP enters and fills her up.
Yeah, she reaches for the cross that's not there to grab onto, so she grabs onto the thing that is in the room now.
And I wonder if that's tacit. Well, I mean, she's, like I said, she's in a billion bits now, so it's immaterial. But that, to me, said that she was thawing a little bit, that she was finding something else that she could cling to, something she could live for.
Yeah.
Yabu's a shitbag. I mean, these are men that he knows. These are, you know, these are Toranaga's men. They all have the brown Jedi robes on, and he encourages them to drink up because there's a lot to celebrate, and then just fucking prison shanks this guy.
Yeah, he's getting everybody drunk. And
he sounds alive for the whole thing. The guy's like, every time he gets that dagger, he's like, oh, God. That's got to be one of the worst ways to go.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to die that way. He wipes the blood on his hands off on his own robes when he's got perfectly good dead man's robes there. Wipe them on the dead guy's robes, man. You might have to present yourself as not part of this, and you don't want to have blood all over
yourself.
Well, I
wonder if that was going to be his evidence, the fact, like, I resisted. I was the one that found the shinobi. Like, I do think this shitface is trying to cover his bases. So
he
that,
is, yeah, when he shouts, oh, intruders, later.
Yeah. But you see the grapple hooks, and as soon as I thought, like, maybe Yabushige himself was going to betray him. But then as soon as the grapple hooks went up there, I'm like, oh, this is some ninja shit.
Yeah, like, and Yabu opens
right
the gate
away.
For him.
Yeah.
And this, one detail I really love is when he's at the gate here and he's opened it for this guy who's kind of orchestrating this attack. He lets a certain set of shinobi in there to attack. And then he's tapping on Yabu's shoulder. Did you notice that?
Was it Yabu's shoulder? Or was he tapping on his own neck? I thought, I actually couldn't figure out what the hell he was doing.
Oh, I thought he was tapping on Yabu's shoulder. Either way, it serves a purpose. I think what he's doing is timing out the rhythm of the attack, because when he gets to a certain point in these taps, he lets another group in. I think they have drilled this so many times. This is like that scene in Better Call Saul where they're going over the raid on the mall.
Yeah.
I think that's what it is. It was really cool detail.
Yeah, like, and I knew they were doing some Navy SEAL shit. I wasn't sure if he was, like, every time he taps, like, two more ninja went in, or he was, like, using his pulse to time something or what, but I knew it was some kind of Special Forces shit. And we get I mean, it's, they put on a full Ninja Gaiden. You get to see them using their shuriken, slitting throats of people as they sleep. Yabu takes this opportunity to call for help, so he looks like the good guy. John Blackthorne and Mariko manage to fight a few of them off with the help of his hand cannon, their desire not to kill her, and her skill with the blade. And it's so funny because Yabu's like, hey, we gotta get to the gates, the escape, when obviously into a waiting arm of a circle of ninjas. But the lady's like, nah, we want to go to this or we want to go that. And Mariko suggests the storehouse with heavy doors, and the surprise Pikachu face that Yabu makes, that like, oh my god, they're not going to just trust me. Yeah. Do you think these women are going to be like panicked hens and just cluck, 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 and you're just going to strut up there and they're going to, because no, man. Yeah, well, he's an idiot.
Well, they're all kind of idiots. I mean, storehouse is a terrible place to go. I mean, even if they don't explode the door here, well, okay, so maybe she's relying on the fact that they don't want to kill her, and it's pretty apparent. Because backing yourself into a corner that way, it could be burned, and you could just be, you could either be smoked out, or you could just be killed.
My thought is that she, maybe she knows what shinobi have in terms of weapons and tools, and she's thinking, like, okay, if we get in a stone building with the big, sturdy wooden door, we can hole out for a couple minutes until help arrives. Because this, like, shinobi attack can't go on indefinitely. Like, the more people find out, it's like, you know, like, these guys got to get in and out. But I that's the other thing, is like, I either Yabushiga is overstating the effect of these explosions, or these shinobi are really sloppy, because clearly they're ordered not to take Mariko alive. We see them trying to carry her off bodily. I don't think Ishido wants her dead. I think,
and that's why she, and she knows that, and that's why she stands against this door, I think.
Exactly. And here's the other thing, is like, she's always been introduced as Mariko, Tato Mariko, which is, you know, the clan of her husband. And in this last moment, she identifies herself as Mariko Akechi, or Akechi Mariko. She's saying, I am my father's daughter, and I do this to protest Ishido's bullshit. And and in her mid-death statement, she's blown to bits.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out the calculus here on Ishido's part. So he's given her permits to leave the city, the castle. He has also sent shinobi after her to not kill her, but to grab her and presumably whisk her away in silence here. Like, I'm curious what effect he wants this to have. So if Mariko just disappears, instead of dying, being killed, or leaving the city, that's kind of a middle path, I guess. He can say, well, I gave her the permits. I don't know where she is. She's gone.
I think
all of their house here has been just slaughtered.
Yeah, again, this is a mere surmisal, but I'm guessing the plan was the house gets slaughtered, all the great ladies are kidnapped, and then in the morning they clean this up, and in the morning Ishido's like, oh, she just left early. She left in the dead of night. You know, like the treacherous pig she is. And all the ladies went with her and all the men. See? The castle's empty. Like,
yeah, but
and,
how does that help his cause? Because he doesn't want the other lords to leave also. They could just leave. The only way it helps his cause is if they are too afraid to leave. So they would have to know that he kidnapped her or something. I mean,
well, as a, one of those, like, you know, it's like the soft, it's a slow transition from soft coup to hard coup, where it's like his lies about what happened. Because does anyone believe that Mariko would leave in the middle of the night like a thief?
Not but after her performance earlier, no.
Right, but
she'd want everyone to see that.
But it's a, it's an absurd lie meant to not be believed, because it's an implicit threat that if you try to push this permit shit, you'll get the same. But it is, because I don't know. Like, Ishido's trying to find the middle path, and I just don't think there is. I don't think there is.
Ochiba says there isn't. Yeah, he's trying, and I don't think. necessarily Ochiba was in on this Yabu plan with the shinobi stuff.
Probably not, although I don't know what she would think of it if someone asked her. It's really interesting because, like, I don't think there is a third path because they're just still reacting to Torunaga. Like, Torunaga's had the initiative almost this entire time, either by accident with Naginata doing crazy crap for him, or intentionally by his own machination. So it's like, Ishido, how are you going to find a third path when you're just still reacting what the other guy's doing?
Yeah, and it's interesting because at some point, Torunaga stole that initiative. Because, maybe not. I mean, if you go all the way back, he's been amassing lords.
I mean, Ochiba taking her hostage, like, that seems like it was the first. As soon as, like, it seems like post-death of Taiko, his whole thought is, Torunaga's whole thought is, I'm going to acquire enough wealth and power to be able to stand against the other five councilmen.
Yeah.
And then when wind of it and started challenging him, his first move was to take the heir's mother captive. Not captive.
Hostage, yeah.
He's a Shido-ing her, right.
Yep.
And he knew that that would buy him time and the council, because it seems like it takes the council forever to do anything.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, well, did he actually? Oh, well, we need to get him here and ask what he's doing before. But, that gives him more weeks of time to plan and scheme and get spies in place. And I keep coming back to, like, why am I rooting for Torunaga? Because Torunaga, this episode shows that he is one of the most ruthless sons of bitches I've ever, ever cheered for. Like, he fed Mariko into this chipper just as a political pawn.
Absolutely.
Is this the guy I want running Japan? Like, I don't think I want Ishido either, but oh my God, can...
Yeah, no, it all comes down to motives.
Can I vote third party in this Shogun election? Because I don't know that we've got a great... Torunaga seems fucking scary and not right. Like, his ability to form relationships with people seems like it's completely severed by his brutal upbringing and all the hostagery and all that. Like, he just... But you need...
Yeah, I mean, it comes
back... You need a guy like that.
It comes back to what Rico Suave, I can't remember his freaking name, was talking to Blackthorn about. Like, look at Osaka. When you go to Osaka and you look at Osaka, think about what type of man it takes to rule that place, to bring order to that. And Torunaga might be, he might just be a product of it, take your pick between tyrants here, because you've got either Ishido or you've got Ochiba, and they're tyrants in their own ways. If Torunaga's motives are more pure, then that might be the guy you want on top of it, as opposed to the others.
Yeah.
Not ultimately. Ultimately, it would be great to have a different system entirely, but, like, in that system, you might be the best.
I don't know if it'll always be this way throughout human history, but it does seem through a great deal that sometimes you need a son of a bitch to forge a nation state, to take tribes and turn them into a city, to take cities and turn them into a country, to take, it's like sometimes you gotta break a few eggs to make an omelet. And
I guess I prefer there to be many people deciding to break that egg as opposed to
democracy.
Just one, right? Because that gets dangerous real fast.
Sure. Yeah. No, I get it. And I too do not want a feudal monarch to rule over me.
But the reality of the situation sometimes.
But before we had mechanisms where that could happen, you had to have one guy who, looked at the board, saw the pieces, saw the sentiment of the people, and's like, all right, time to upend it.
And you just hope that guy cares about the people in the end and not just his own wealth and prosperity.
Yeah, but, like, the thing is, like, even if he's not, even if he's just doing it to enrich himself, like, unifying Japan is probably a good thing.
Sure,
like, long term,
sure.
It seems like the time's arrow points towards greater complexity of human institutions, organizations, more of them under the one umbrella. You look at the time of, like, if it's Star Trek or Expanse, if you want dystopia or utopian vision of future, all of them depicted Earth united under one government, because why the fuck wouldn't we? After 100 years of more fighting and squabbling and resource scarcity, like, it just makes a lot of sense.
It's definitely.
I know there's a lot of things to be afraid of, but, you know, people are really afraid when we overthrew feudalism, too. Oh, my God, you're going to let the common men have a say? Yep. Oh, my God, these people are uneducated. They aren't going to make their own decisions. We have to put guardrails around it. And look at us now. Look how awesome we're running the world. You know, no problems. Hmm. It's going to keep getting better. But yeah, honestly, it's like, I don't even know if, like, you know, like Genghis Khan wasn't a good person, but...
Oh, God, no.
He left a huge mark on the world, you know?
Yeah.
Alexander the Great probably wasn't a good person, but he left his mark on the world sometimes. Because, like, yeah, meek, humble, well-adjusted men probably don't go out and become a warlord and try to take over half the world.
I don't think they do.
Men will really try to overthrow the legitimate heir and take and unite a country instead of going to therapy. That's that old joke.
Pretty much. Yeah. I'm excited to see who lives and who dies next episode. I'm with you. I think Mariko 100% dead. I mean, that explosion is so violent. That door flies off in a million pieces with her pressed against it.
Yeah. She shouldn't even have a final last say. Like, there shouldn't be a body to cradle. Like,
yeah. Unrecognizable, probably.
She should be so much English rabbit stew.
Blackthorn. Toranaga's consort, wife, whatever she is.
Can I put a big wager on the board?
Okay, yeah.
I want to bet a lot of internet points and prestige on this. Yabashiga survives. He is the cockroach.
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he was essentially just... I know this is not literally how it's staged, but he might as well been, and it would have been funnier if he was cowering behind the women saying, get over here.
Yeah, women and children first to face the blast wave.
Right. Use them as fodder, as cushioning. But yeah, I'm with you. I think he survives.
Yeah, Mariko's already a shock. I'm doing 50-50 on Toranaga having the, you know, victorious king ending or the gladiator ending.
Okay.
Pretty convinced Blackthorn survives.
Yep.
For largely meta narrative reasons. Someone's got to survive to tell the tale, you know? I don't know who else. Do you think Fuji will ever see Fuji? Will Fuji... Because, like, I think that's interesting that her grandfather and her entire family is dead. Like, that would be a nice callback to, aren't you sure you don't want to live to enjoy the realm that we're fighting so far, to enjoy the peace that we win. Like, I would like to see Fuji in her home, you know, at peace. That would be a nice thing to see.
Yeah, I think Mariko is a big enough blow. They don't need anybody else to die. And honestly, no one in that room would be a bigger blow than her. So, like...
Here's a big one.
Yeah.
Buntaro. Because I could see it, him living as
there?
Just of like him being forced to outlive his steam father and his wife would be an interesting karmic payback for someone who's been so cruel to Mariko, but also him being dead would be satisfying too.
And Mariko being so cruel to him back in that last episode really just drive that knife in. Yeah, I hope he's alive. Get some feedback about that. Maybe it's time to get to feedback.
Yeah, probably should. We're taking a long time here. Shogun at baldmove.com. We got one more week. We'll probably do a wrap up, I imagine.
I would think so.
Plus, we're also talking about wanting to come back and do like the mini series or something. We need to put some thought into that and see what hard promises we're ready to make. But yeah, Shogun at baldmove.com. If you want to send in feedback, don't forget we're everywhere at baldmove on social media. And if you'd like to support what we're doing here and get bonus content, we got weekly shows, we got ad free feeds, we got tons of value for you, the supporter. Check out support.baldmove.com. All right, Jim, let's see what the people had to say. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.ballmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. And now, back with more Bald Move.
I'll start off with Chris, who says, one quick perspective on your comments from the on the formal tea ceremony that Bentaro provides for Mariko. Jim noted the modest appearance of the tea bowl, apparently called a chawan, and wondered why they couldn't find something more elegant, which, you know, is mostly a joke. But this is very much by design, where the imperfections and irregularities of the bowl are prized and featured prominently. The scene captured the Zen-influenced beauty of the tea ceremony that I thoroughly enjoyed. Yeah, mine was mostly a tongue-in-cheek joke, because anything they're doing on this show, they have a reason for it.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I'm getting a little, I'm not sure, annoyed or amused at people like pointing out, well, actually, when like it's a point of fact that the show that they were using not super nice cups as a negotiating strategy with the madame.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, our good china is broken. So we've broken out our, do they call China Japan?
I don't know. Probably
our good Japan
not.
Is broken. So,
our good Nihon.
And we didn't have time to kashugi anything together. So, I get it. Like that, but I don't think or at least my surmisal was that there was probably nicer lacquer bowls. This isn't what you would set out to really impress somebody. There's also the other thing is like, would they set their best stuff out for this, you know, essentially whoremonger?
Would they
let Lord Toranaga's wife drink from the same cup as a madame? I think there's other layers here, but yeah, obviously it's not like a peasant cup.
Yeah, it's it has meaning within this ceremony. Which is nice.
Joel says, I'm rereading the book right now and I've completely forgotten how many colorful euphemisms that are used to describe genitalia. Peerless pestle, steaming shaft, piece of meat, jade gate. Oh, we must be switching genitalia.
Yeah,
jade pavilion, vermilion chamber. Chamber, m'lady. I figured I would give you guys a taste since I remember Aaron got a kick out of the bath scene in the book where Blackthorn gets excited and Mura and his mother are happy about the situation. I hope you guys are having a rap podcast and maybe even a read along over the summer. That will not happen. There's no way we can do a read along for a 1300 page book in the summer of Hot D. But I would also love to hear a discussion about the book versus show comparisons, and I'm guessing you guys would have an audience for it. That might come back. Ooh. That might happen on OTC like months from now.
After you finish reading the book. Because we'd have to read like 200 pages a week. It'd be insane.
Yeah. That's a lot, but I'm going to do it. And what we might do, like I alluded to early in the podcast, is watch the old miniseries. I think we can polish that off in 6 hours, and I'm keen to do it.
Yeah, that'd
like
be
in
cool.
fact, I almost started last night because I'm like, God damn, it's just a finale. I can watch the first episode, right? But I'm like, nah, I really don't want to get any kind of, you know, I want to keep pure for the Shogun experience. But afterwards,
just one more week.
I don't. And again, I can't promise because that we're going to cover it because, you know, we got a whole bunch of other stuff to cover. But I have certainly enjoyed Shogun and I understand a desire to extend the experience. He says also about episode 9, I liked it. There was a bit of a departure from the book with a few things, but that's expected in any adaptation. I was worried that they weren't going to revisit the relationship with Blackthorn and Mariko because of the way things were going episode 6 and 8. Same, brother. The fact that in the book their romance had already happened, giving the two of them their moment after the seppuku attempt gave it more meaning in my opinion. Overall, I like the way it's done. I don't have an opinion, but I did like the way it's done on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I also liked watching the evolution of John Blackthorne becoming the Anjin-san, or Anjin-sama, as he's upgraded to this episode. Throughout the show, he slowly adapts more and more Japanese customs. They starts off slowly with him being forced to wear the kimono and take a bath, and eventually gets to where we ended up in episode 9. This is in part guided by Mariko's deft hand, but also those around him. To see him pick up the sword and offer to be Mariko's second shows how far he's come. This would have been completely unthinkable for him in episode 3 or 4, but at this phase of the journey, he's completely adapted to the culture and its customs. I am with Jim. I don't think that Blackthorn would have got that done in one chop.
Yeah, maybe I'm wrong. He's just not a swordsman. Give him a gun, like, also, he could shoot your head off in one shot, but...
The katana's not an easy blade to use. Like, it's not, it's, yeah, you gotta really use that curved edge and you gotta, like, pull through the cut. And if you're used to just using a rapier or a broadsword or, you know, a standard arming sword, I don't know that you'd have the skills. I mean, I've watched students trying to cut through wet mats of bamboo. It's not easy.
At least he understands the meaning and the purpose of it all, you know, whether he gets that done in one chop or 20, he gets why she's doing it in this scene at this point.
He takes one swing and then takes his pistol. Fuck it, this ain't working. All right, Hannah F says this motherfucker playing Buntaro is amazing because he's making me feel. Oh, I'm so sorry. It's on a roll. I reverted back to form.
Yeah, here we go. All right, let's move over to Hannah F. Says, this motherfucker playing Buntaro is amazing because he makes me feel bad for a piece of shit wife abuser. The writing and the acting makes me check myself. I was literally talking to myself like, bitch, he's a monster, when I felt sympathy for him. Why do the writers want me to care for his character? Please tell me I'm not alone in praising his performance. You are not.
Yeah, there's people I saw making side eye in the Discord about people empathizing with them. But, like, I don't know, man.
You have to take it all in context. This is the thing. He's not a piece of shit wife abuser by the culture of this time. So it's hard to condemn him hundreds of years on saying, like, oh, this is something that he shouldn't have known better.
Yeah, I don't think it's fair to put him in the same category as your normal drunken wife abuser. Like, most people don't have wives that they've been trying to spare for 15 years a suicide pact and would love to kill themselves more than they would love to share a bed with you or a kind word to you. And I'm not excusing it, but, like, that's what makes him a great character. Like, I've empathized with murderers. I've empathized with the worst sort of backstabbing traitors. I've empathized with, just like all kinds of situations because I don't know. The other thing about this is, like, I feel like it's an important skill to be able to see another person's viewpoint, even if you violently disagree with it, because else, how do you know you're not going to follow down that same path? Sure. You know, like, if you understand the Buntaro, then I think it's at least as plausible that you're going to eventually come away with a resolution not to be like him, as you are like, oh, I think Buntaro is fucking based. I'm going to start slapping him. It's like, yeah, like, what's the worry here? Now, I can understand that if you're a woman who's been abused by a man, none of this shit is going to make you feel anything for him because your personal experience is going to overwrite that. But I get it. Like, there's a reason I didn't like Succession. It's because fuck those rich people. Get therapy. Like, if anyone dies in that show, did anyone die in Succession? Because if anyone dies in that show, like, holy hell. I just can't get in. I can't get into Narcos movies anymore. You know, like, I saw, like, it's just such a fucking tragedy what we're doing to our southern neighbors with our own bullshit drug policy that I can't enjoy even heroic, well-told tales set in that universe. It's just all so depressing to me. So I get it. If a man's roughed you up, made you feel unsafe, you don't have to explain to me why you can't get in Buntaro's head, but I've definitely suffered violence at the hands of men, but it's not the same. So I can definitely condemn him for being a piece of shit wife abuser, but also being like, God damn, that is a tragic, tragic situation. Just like I can excuse Yabushiga for being a torturer and a murderous bastard, but God damn, he's entertaining. So it's a TV show. Yeah. I don't think we have to think too much hard about it, you know?
Yeah, I think it does show the skill of the writers if you are sympathizing with a guy who clearly has these flaws.
Mm-hmm. Because the other thing is, he's also got a lot of admiral qualities, you know?
Yes.
Like, if it not for Mariko's, something that wasn't his fault, if it not for Mariko's father killing the warlord, if the warlord wasn't such a murderous bastard that he needed to be killed, imagine what kind of life they could have had together. Although it does seem like Mariko never was much for Bentaro from just like a class and prestige thing. That would have been an uphill climb. But he's also a hell of a samurai. Extremely noble, skilled, brave, courageous, all those things. So it's like, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
Yeah.
And we can feel bad for tragic things happening. David says, I'm still getting over what went through watching what I went through watching that. I'm in bits. What a fantastic show this is. It's got everything. Nothing more to add. I'm just really glad you guys will be there soon to share your thoughts with it. Mariko is one of the greatest characters I've ever seen on screen. Yeah, I've said that Yabushiga is my favorite, but Mariko might be the best. Probably is the best.
Yeah, I mean, between her backstory and the things that she has been asked to do over the course of the current timeline, it's pretty impressive.
And what she's able to emote with very limited, like, to me, this performance is as hard to pull off as Natalie Portman's Queen Amidala. And Natalie Portman completely failed,
God.
And she's crushing it. It's like this is very weird, stilted. Also, if you don't know, Anna Sawai is fluent in both English and Japanese, but this is like archaic Japanese. I've heard it described as this is like very Shakespearean, where everyone's thee, thou, and milady, and yea, verily, and it's not modern Japanese at all. So like she's doing this very structured, very controlled, very precise performance, and emoting so much through it.
Yeah. It reminds me of basically any of the Android performances I've seen that have been really stellar, where there's this tight window that you can operate in as far as emotions go, but you need to be doing so much more under the surface, and that has to be coming through to really sell that character, and she's nailing it.
Yeah, it reminds me of, was it Laura Byrne from Foundation?
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like 99% of the time she's not doing anything, but that 1% watch the fuck out. And I granted the bear is still in our future, and I don't give much a shit about the Emmys, but Anna Sawai, hopefully I'll get her name right by the time we record, but like she's probably gonna make some noise in next year's Baldies, man.
Could be
all-time all right. Performance.
Let's see what Father Martin has to say. He says he's taking a break from his extensive head shaving routine to write in. What an incredible show. Everything's coming up Torunaga. Peasant Ishido looks like a tyrant. Lady Ochiba realizes that despite everything, Torunaga is still winning. He has them, here's the Zugzwang. He has them in the Zugzwang. The stage is set for the return of the king. My main question is, how much credit can we give him? From some angles, he looks, I think he's talking about Torunaga here, he looks almost omniscient. I keep coming back to that three hearts conversation. Torunaga's true heart has to be a final act reveal. Is his ruthlessness primarily in service of Japan or himself? Can't wait to find out.
It's pretty perceptive, that final act reveal.
Yeah.
Yeah, he probably won't know till he runs the air through.
The music will tell us as he sits on the throne, right?
Yes.
It'll either be dark and ominous, or it'll be auspicious. I don't know.
So he sits and turns to the camera and says, this has all really been a shogun.
Yep.
Franklin says, I think the ninjas or shinobi were supposed to capture Mariko and prevent her from leaving Osaka or killing herself. Correct. I think Torunaga counted on Yabushiga betraying him to generate some move that Mariko could then use to put the blame on Ishido, hoping that gets most, if not everyone, to turn on him. And I think Yabushiga is fucked after this. I don't know. Yabushiga hasn't been fucked yet. Not even by the courtesan. His attainer did it, so he's unfuckable. Interesting that they more fully... Oh, also, I think Torunaga has 17 different ways to win. Like, if Mariko goes there and says, I'm leaving, and Ishido shits his pants and does nothing, he wins. If he prevents her, and they fight her, he wins. If they kill her, he wins. If she kills herself, he wins. If Yabushiga betrays him with the shinobi and ends up killing her, she wins. The only way he can lose is if she gets captured, and Mariko's not going to let that happen. He's trusting her. And as a badass woman herself that carries a blade, there's no conceivable way she could ever be caught captured. So, like, I think he's just got, there's just no, he's once he's engineered a situation and unfolds, there's no way he can lose.
Could be.
It's probably why he doesn't start many battles. Anyway, Franklin continues, it's interesting that they more fully fleshed out Mariko's motivations to reclaim her family's honor, as she loves her father in spite of the terrible thing he did and wants to bring about a world where her son does not have to be ashamed of his lineage. In her first declaration before her scheduled suicide, she mentions her father, and that last one just before the blast, she takes his name as her own, perhaps hoping that it redeemed it to be redeemed through her heroism. Maybe that's what Toranaga promised her. It reminds me of my college studies in the very early China, where aspiring civil servants had to pass tests mainly based on Confucian philosophy. A core tenet of that was merchants were of low disreputable class. This was ironic because the ones who could afford the tutors to train their sons on the tests were, in large part, families from the disreputable class. So you get a rising group of officials who are conflicted. The core tenet about merchants was clear, but so was that of filial. Is it how you say family? Is it that word, filial?
I believe filial. That's it, filial.
Hasafade incorporated. That piety, which required these officials to honor their evil parents. Convoluted way of saying it reminds me of Mariko, and writing this is a way of honoring my parents who paid for this learning. They sound like disreputable, Franklin.
I think we need the rich to feel a little more disreputable than they do. Have a little bit more shame and guilt.
Hey, it's an even playing field. I don't know what you're talking about. Doesn't matter.
Well, of course.
Doesn't matter.
I feel it every day. I feel how even we are. Philly Nick writes in, I think every couple of years I write you Anjins. I started every time he writes us, he starts with, this is the best TV episode of modern TV. Jim, I know you love Breaking Bad dearly, and Aaron, we love The Leftovers dearly. The season of Shogun is amazing TV, and dare I to say episode 9 was amazing TV. So my actual question is, which walk was more impactful? Queen Cersei's walk back to the Red Keep or Mariko's attempted walk out of Osaka Castle?
I feel like any Game of Thrones comparison is an auto lose because it just shit the bed so hard.
Yeah.
But that the Walk of Shame was still in the kind of heyday. It's probably the twilight of the heyday. That's season 5, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's a moment where you're supposed to feel bad for a character you hate. This is a moment where you're supposed to feel sort of triumphant in a weird way for a character you love. So to me, it's Mariko's walkout is the better scene overall, the way I feel about it. Mm. But they're both very good scenes.
Yeah, and it's also really hard. I've seen people making, because you can compare this to Game of Thrones in terms of tone and how it feels and the wheels it's spinning and the levers it's pulling. It's really hard to compare a 10 episode limited series to a show that has 8 seasons of 10 plus episodes each. I know the last ones didn't, but you know what I'm saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
It's really hard to judge like Shogun versus Breaking Bad, Shogun versus The Leftovers. You had 30 hours to tell your story of The Leftovers, you got 10 hours of Shogun. Also The Leftovers was based on adapted work that they exhausted all the material like halfway through the first season and it just kept on going. Like if Shogun did 2 more seasons derived off the plot of the first Shogun book, then you could be in a conversation. But I just, you can compare it to other limited series. So let's say this, mm-hmm. I think compares extremely favorably well to Chernobyl.
To say that Chernobyl's bad. It's just, they're both very good.
That's what I'm saying. It compares very favorably. It's like I'm not even sure, especially since I haven't seen the last episode. This, I doubt it because the book is so well regarded, but like it's possible this thing doesn't stick the landing and shits to bed. But I doubt it. But yeah, like Chernobyl is up there. I'm trying to think of like all the other limited series. Sharp Objects. I fucking love Sharp Objects.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was an amazing limited series with another hateable characters that you could nevertheless feel empathy for. Yeah, why am I having a hard time coming up or thinking about all this? Because I know there's been quite a few, but yeah, it's just hard. You kind of almost can. You got to, yeah, well, because it's you build up this huge audience, and then what do you do
and
with
it's
them?
Gone.
Hopefully,
yeah.
Hopefully they follow. They like you enough. They follow you onto something else. But yeah, I can't think of a clearly better limited miniseries in the last decade, and probably not before then, because that's kind of the start of the golden age. So. It's good stuff. Nathan says, what an episode, hey? I have some thoughts. I'm confused about the exchange in front of Mariko by Yabushiga and Blackthorn, where Yabushiga is giving him instructions and going to see Ishido, and Blackthorn seems to understand the keywords, then tells him in Portuguese-English that they'll take the Catholic gold. It almost seems staged for Mariko's benefit, but I'm not sure if it's part of any plan or just to mess with her. I think it's just one of them failures in communication.
Okay, could be.
Like,
I'm a little confused by that too.
I think it's showing the mastery that Blackthorn has, relative mastery of the language that he has versus Yabushiga doesn't even know English. So that's what my thought was. The costuming's been spectacular, but a special shout out to the kimono Mariko and the other women are wearing in the departure scene. They are exquisite. Kimonos like these can cost easily $10,000 to $20,000 today. I saw, I think it was an Insider article going in about the kimonos that Mariko's wearing and talking about what high quality they are. They look amazing. Everything just looks so fucking perfect.
Yeah, all the costuming across the board has been amazing. I think back to like Saki's kimono that I don't know if it's called a kimono when a dude is wearing it. I have
no
idea.
His battle robes.
Yeah, that he was wearing.
Oh, no. His bathing. Yeah, it's pure. It's like a seppuku robe. Does every samurai buy that at the beginning of their career and just like Saiki's like, I'm not going to waste my seppuku robe. I'm going to.
I'm thinking of the one he was wearing during the dinner or the drinking session where he insults and reveals the plan. That thing.
It's the one he's wearing through the whorehouse, too. It's just like a plain white silk kimono, right? Just like
maybe. I don't remember the whorehouse scene.
Because I know you had an amazing just pure white kimono that I'm kind of starting to associate with suicide at this point.
Yeah, but, and then Toranaga's stuff has been incredible.
Man. Yeah, his dream armor. Which we'll probably get to see some more of next. We've never actually seen him in his dream armor, except for when he's sneaking out of the castle. We saw him wearing it under women's clothes. Like, that's something they established, that he had this armor forged based on something he saw in a dream. And we're like, oh, man, when the dream armor comes out. But
I guess he used it during the bandit attack, right? Quote, unquote, bandit attack.
But he was still, like, I thought he had a robe over it or something.
Maybe. I don't remember.
Anyway, I'm looking to see more of it. The scene between... Or, I'm sorry, the use of poetry in this episode and the avoidance of exoticizing it is awesome. It really shows that poetry is a means of communication. Mariko's chosen opening line for the contest was a direct message to Ochiba, and both Yabushiga and Ishido scoff at it because it defies seasonal conventions. It's not just there to be like, oh, Japanese samurai like poetry. That isn't that so refined and sophisticated. It means something. Then we get to the actual argument about leaving, and Mariko cuts every comment about being Akechi's daughter, about not being a peasant to be trodden upon, but coming from a line of 1,000 years of samurai. Everything is a cut at either Ochiba, the Akechi part, or Ishido, who is of a peasant background. The scene between Ochiba and Mariko was also out of this world. First, the wink JB gives to the heirs a nice nod to the book without making it a huge deal of it. That's funny. Apparently, Clavel didn't think that Japanese knew how to wink.
Okay,
that's like saying a Japanese doesn't know how to make the okay symbol. Like, maybe they haven't been taught like the societal meaning, but like, yeah, that seems stupid on the face of it that they just lack the ability to close one eye.
And now every teenage girl in Japan does it in every selfie they take, so
right. I didn't mention that in the notes. I forgot to, but like, I did really like how instantly charming he was when he flashed in that like kind of wink and the kid just giggles. And that was the audience with the air. That was the audience with the air was concluded at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's possible to catch in English subtitles, but there's a massive shift in tone once the air and the guards are dismissed, and the linguistic switches are dazzling. And we get poetry as a weapon again in the end. The flowers are only flowers because they fall is a line from the real life Mariko, according to the official podcast, and it was magical. These two actresses are enthralling together, and then the handhold afterwards between JB and Mariko is emotional even for grumpy old me. That's amazing. First of all, because I listened to the podcast and I missed that line because I was working on my notes at the time. But yeah, that makes perfect sense that that's actually something Mariko wrote and they're just repurposing it at this point. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the seppuku scene. First off, Kiyama, total coward. Even if he didn't show up because he knew Ishido would cave, he's still a coward. It's great storytelling that John steps up to fill the Kaishaku role. That's the second. But A, has anyone taught him how to wield the sword beside the one time on the beach with Yabashiga? And B, there's a samurai right there holding the sword. Why not have him do it rather than let John botch it? He'd do worse than 12-year-old Torunaga. I wonder that, too. If the guy, but is the guy holding that sword really a samurai, or is he one of the... Because you see all the guys in like the brown pajamas standing with the guys in the armor. And I always assumed that the guys in armor are samurai and the other guys are just like they're squires or like peasant soldiers.
I mean, I think if anybody's going to have the context for it, it's Nathan. So I don't want to
But if they're carrying a katana, they have to be samurai, right? Otherwise, they'd have
unless
one of the
swords. Unless they're there to carry the sword of their lord, right? Because I've seen that
right,
a
like
lot,
a,
too.
Like a squire.
Lord's like,
bring me my sword.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are usually young boys, though.
But I wonder if a squire is considered a samurai. Like, he's a cadet samurai, but he's still a samurai.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Really don't know.
Well, yeah, if you care to write in another Bible about that stuff, Nate, give us a ring. Chad says, God damn it.
Jesus, man. All right, let's move over to Chad, who says, I want to turn your attention to the film Silence. Sorry if this has already been mentioned or talked about. Silence is a 2016 Martin Scorsese period film.
Dealing with
the persecution of Christians in Japan around the year 1639, so almost 40 years after Shogun setting. Film mainly follows two Portuguese priests played by Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver.
I did not know this, but yes!
We've come to Japan during the Edo period, a shogunate, to search for another priest played by Liam Neeson, who's been said to have renounced his Christianity. The film is a perfect pseudo-sequel to Shogun, and I would swear that some of the sets are the same from the film and the show. It's a fantastic film, and if you're if anyone is hungry for more when Shogun ends, it's a perfect follow-up to it. Also, the Yabashiga actor Tadanobu Asano plays a large role in the film as well.
This is like the Vince McMahon meme, because I just want to lean back in my chair, fall out of it. So as soon as I looked at this guy's Wikipedia page, and I'm looking like, oh, Ichi the Killer. Okay, I can see that. Zatoshi the Blind Swordsman. Oh, I've always wanted to see that. Oh, I remember him being in Thor, now that I mention it. And then I got to this fucking thing. Martin Scorsese directed him in a... I might watch that this fucking weekend.
This is 2016 is like the perfect time for it to be right before our Scorsese-sance or whatever we've had in the last several years, where we've just been watching a string of Scorsese movies and podcasts.
I've watched like three or four a year for the last 3 or 4 years.
But modern enough for me to like never have really known about it, because there was a period where I just wasn't like paying attention to these types of movies, and 2016 is right in there. So
yeah,
that's exciting.
I think this is super cool. I want to watch it this weekend. Tadanobu Asano is just so iconic as Yabashiga that I kind of want to see him in everything. He's got so much, he's just got it, man. He's got that charisma, that star energy. I hope he gets big opportunities.
I think both of those guys are.
I knew Sonata could cook. I mean, I've seen him in a bunch of stuff. And he's also in Mortal Kombat, the 2021 Mortal Kombat. Mm-hmm. He plays Lord Raiden, and he's going to reprise that role in the sequel that's filming now, which is super exciting because Raiden is like one of my favorite characters from Mortal Kombat. And I remember being impressed with Raiden, but
maybe he'll get more to do in the next one. Didn't he not have a huge role?
No, Raiden, in the last one. Yeah.
So maybe he gets more to do in the next sequel.
I hope so, because damn, that's really cool. Yeah, this guy, I want to watch a bunch of stuff with him in it just to see if it holds, you know, I imagine it does. Yeah, you see this thing he's capable of. It's like wanting to see more Bryan Cranston once he finished with Breaking Bad.
Totally.
You know, he is permanently on my map for this role alone. All right, Michael says, I know this will be controversial, but I did think Hiroyuki Sanada is doing a better job portraying Lord Toranaga than Toshiro Mifune did. I mean, I haven't seen it. That is some bold shit to be talking. I know it's an 80, it's like a 40-year-old miniseries at this point, but Toshiro Mifune.
Yeah, icon.
That's like saying the Japanese Marlon Brando ain't shit. Mm-hmm. Because he you know, or Russell Crowe was a better Jor-El than he was. Like, I don't know. I don't know. Are we even talking about the primes, the material? This is a fucking basic network television miniseries in the '80s.
Versus prestige television.
Yeah. The budget's like two orders of magnitude higher. But I get what you're saying. Like, I bet that I'm going to find bunches of the old Shogun miniseries downright hokey. I've already been put off by some of the character portraits I've seen because it seems like all the women are just done at this elaborate geisha. I really like like everybody feels like, I don't know, like it's the, here's what it is. It's the difference between the armor in Excalibur, the movie, and the difference between the armor in Game of Thrones.
Okay.
One is a person who has seen a picture of a knight, maybe cracked a book and like highly stylizes that one thing. And another person has gone through, done the research, see what people look comfortable, see what looks natural, see what works in practice versus on the sketchbook. And that's what I'm. But again, I haven't seen Shogun, at least for a long time. I do vividly remember the dude getting boiled scene. That really scared me as a kid, but yeah, this is adult shit. I was like five at the time. I didn't care about it. It says also, Michael continues, could I please see a buddy comedy where Yabushiga and Blackthorn are pirates on the high seas? Look, I could go for a Blackthorn Yabushiga spinoff.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Them being pirate buddies. Come on. Thinking that awesome video someone made of the Hound and Arya starring in an 80s spinoff. Oh yeah, the other massively entertaining traveling roadshow of our times.
Mm-hmm. How many chickens will they eat? Every chicken on the ship?
I would just love to see both Blackthorn and Yabushiga on some kind of diversion along the lines of what was an episode 3 where Blackthorn is like, oh, the shame! You know, like when he was trying to keep Toranaga from being discovered. Like, imagine Yabushiga with his bullshit and John on his bullshit simultaneously.
Right. And then throw in the Spanish pirate guy, because I really loved him. He's fantastic.
Yeah. 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 All three of them together on a poop deck would be it'd be the shit. Okay. That's all of the feedback we got. Did you get another comment to add? Are we still riffing on this idea? All right. Shogun at baldmove.com is how you get your crazy thoughts in, your biblical tomes on Japanese history, and your opinions on Yabushiga and Blackthorn's new adventures. Yabu and the Thorn, coming to Disney Plus this September. Shogun at baldmove.com. What's that?
Thorn and Boo.
Thorn and Boo. Then, check us out on social media at Bald Move. And finally, you can support us at support.baldmove.com. We'll see you next week for the thrilling, we hope, conclusion, and I trust, of Shogun. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
See ya.